Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If your company offers a flexible savings account as part of your healthcare package, you know how tough it is to figure out how much you're going to spend and on what. Well, this year, health insurance companies had to do their own version of that decision, and the result may be more money in your pocket. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used iPhones, iPads, Macs, smartphones, and other gadgets from your home or office, so you can upgrade to the latest versions of your favorite gadgets. Find out what your gadget is worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 26th of April. So maybe you didn't get a tax refund this year, but another check may be headed your way. Part of the healthcare reform law says only a certain percentage of what we pay in premiums can go to things like insurance company profits and administrative costs. Everything else has to be spent on actual healthcare, or we get it back. And in the first year of the program, we are getting back more than $1 billion. From our healthcare desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports.
Dan Harrison of Colorado is my first guest on a game I'll call Guess Your Rebate.
Okay.
Figure Dan spends $700 a month on a high-deductible health plan for his family of four. Under the health care law, only 20% of that can go to profits and administration. So how much of a rebate can Dan expect? Dan?
They were probably pocketing a couple $100 a month out of me, so that would be more like, you know, $2,000 or something.
So the average rebate in Colorado for people buying their own policy is $55.
$55?
Dollars. Nationwide, the average rebate was $127, according to a study by Larry Levitt of the Kaiser Family Foundation, although he says that consumers actually save more than that by getting cheaper policies in the first place.
Insurers knew they were going to have to pay these rebates if they didn't hit spending targets, and many of them held premiums down as a result.
Most insurance companies expect to owe no rebates. Those that do are likely in states with less regulation or less competition.
If you were in a market where you were a monopoly or near monopoly, you could demand higher premiums and consumers and employers didn't have much choice.
Back in Washington, insurance companies are on the hunt for more wiggle room. They're still arguing that paying a broker to sell policies is a medical cost. If they win that fight, rebates next year could be a lot smaller. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
A couple of months ago during the Super Bowl, Chrysler made a big splash with an ad about it being halftime in America. You know, the one with Clint Eastwood doing Clint Eastwood. Well, apparently, halftime is over at Chrysler. Today, the automaker reported its best quarterly earnings in more than a decade. Sales were up almost 40% over the previous quarter. But car sales in general are strong right now, so it's not clear what is driving Chrysler ahead. Sally Herships turns on the headlights.
It's an automotive miracle. I'm talking about Chrysler's really strong sales.
Just a few years ago, most people would have written them off.
Chrysler? Unsavable. Jeremy Anwill is vice chairman of Edmunds.com. He says the auto industry typically does well when an economy recovers. Ford and GM are also reporting record profits. But Chrysler was worst off when the Fed stepped in. Now it's doing much better than the rest. The mystery remains. Normally, when car companies want to boost sales, they sell more to rental companies, not Chrysler.
They've actually reduced sales to the rental companies as well. So the mystery really deepens.
Anwill says the man responsible for the magic is Chrysler CEO Sergio Marchionne.
This is going to sound kind of warm and fuzzy, but he's really got them to act more as a team.
He says the CEO is giving workers shared responsibility so they can't undermine each other. Then there are the warm and fuzzy car commercials.
People are out of work and they're hurting. And they're all wondering what they're going to do to make a comeback. And we're all scared because this isn't a game. The people of Detroit know a little something about this.
Larry Habriniak teaches strategy at Wharton.
The poor people in Detroit are getting some respect. That poor people who have weathered this storm, you know, the 99% are coming back, and we're going to sell cars to this 99%.
Cars imported from Detroit. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Media mogul Rupert Murdoch testified again today in a British government investigation into media ethics and standards. He admitted there had been a cover-up of wrongdoing at one of his British newspapers, The News of the World. He has now shut down that paper. Today he said he didn't know about the extent of illegal activity there. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
He's the world's most powerful media magnate, once courted and feared by politicians on both sides of the pond. But today, a different Rupert Murdoch appeared before the ethics inquiry. Contrite and humble, he apologised profusely for the phone hacking at the News of the World.
But I failed. All I can do is apologise to a lot of people, including all the innocent people in the News of the World who lost their jobs.
But he said the scale of the illegality had been concealed from him. Andrew Neil is a former Murdoch executive. He says that in his 2 days of testimony, his old boss has carefully dodged any suggestion he was complicit in the malpractice.
He's been hosed down by his American lawyers, who've told him not to say anything that could cause trouble in America, where he's under investigation from the SEC, the Department of Justice, and the FBI.
They are reportedly looking at allegations that Murdoch's British journalists bribed police officers. That would be illegal under the US Foreign and Corrupt Practices Act. And then, says Jeff Cohen, professor of journalism at Ithaca College in New York, there's the issue of phone hacking.
If there's phone hacking that's discovered on US soil, that opens up new problems for Rupert Murdoch that he hasn't even fathomed yet.
Civil lawsuits and criminal prosecutions in the US, and, says Cohen, perhaps congressional hearings too. Murdoch may need all the contrition he can muster. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, another day of the happy music, thanks to the housing market. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Saturday marks 20 years since riots swept across South Los Angeles. When the burning, shooting, and looting ended, a swath of low-income Black and Hispanic neighborhoods lay in waste. 53 people were killed, more than 1,000 buildings destroyed. In the aftermath, hundreds of millions of dollars were pledged for rebuilding. But at the time, it was hard to believe how residents would ever prosper again.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman visits South L.A. to see whether, 20 years later, it is any easier for residents to move up the economic ladder.
Just off Crenshaw Boulevard, in the heart of South L.A., there are still empty lots where burned-out buildings were never rebuilt. Fast food, liquor, and payday loans seem available on every corner, but there are precious few groceries, banks, or office buildings. One bright spot, the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Mall. It's been spruced up. There's a Macy's, a celebrity chef's upscale restaurant, and a Walmart, where Daniel Coles has a job, right here in the predominantly African-American neighborhood where he grew up.
I feel that it's great for the community because it gets more convenient for the community to come and shop. Also more convenient for me where I can just take the bus to get to work.
Coles isn't too happy with his $13 an hour pay, but he likes the stores that the mall has attracted nearby. Starbucks, a juice bar, H&R Block.
Certainly what we see is some heroic efforts to establish businesses there.
Paul Ong is an economist at UCLA.
And you do see some success. That being said, if we look at the raw numbers, a better indicator than just some of these sort of visual landmarks. There are only 4 jobs to every 10 workers. This is a job-scarce neighborhood, and the jobs that are there tend to be lower-wage jobs. They're not the type of jobs that would make it easy to move into the middle class.
Ong says for many residents, the way up the economic ladder is to climb out of the neighborhood altogether. And many of those who leave are African-American. Before the riots, South L.A. was about half Black and half Latino. Now, Blacks make up just a third of residents.
I think the first place was on 36th Place.
Robbie Hawkins is 59. She was born and raised and still works in South L.A.
And we moved from there around the corner to East 68th Street, where we were there for 40 years.
Then, in 2005, she sold the family home, where she was living with her mother and her son, who works as a retail manager.
So we moved to a nicer neighborhood.
in the suburban community of Harbor City. She commutes to South L.A. She's a loan portfolio manager for a community lender. So I asked her,
as a resident, are there things you miss?
No, nothing. You want to be able to go to a supermarket that's an Albertsons rather than the little mom-and-pop store. You want to be able to pay prices that are not higher. My car insurance is less expensive now. My cell phone, if I wanted to go to a Rite Aid, a nice one that had anything in it, I had to drive out. Now I live right next door to Rite Aid. There's a Starbucks.
For decades now, African Americans who can afford to have been moving out to the suburbs for better housing and schools, says Paul Ong.
And that sucks a segment of the population out of that area. At the same time, those who are not as well off, cannot afford housing, they are attracted to this area.
That's the new Latino residents, now two-thirds of the population. And it turns out that these two communities are pursuing very different roads to upward mobility, according to Eugene Grigsby. He's a sociologist and city planner. He says blacks try to build family wealth by working for big companies or the government, as utility workers say, or teachers. You buy a house, save for retirement. He says Latinos tend to start small businesses.
The immigrant approach to economic development, you start low, you work 14, 15 hours, you don't pay yourself very much, but you accumulate some capital. Then you can purchase something. Then you can bring some family members over, get them involved, and you can accumulate more capital.
I met Vidal Hernandez at the same community lending agency where Robbie Hawkins works. He and two nephews came here from Mexico around the time of the riots. They worked as cooks and dishwashers, saving everything they could.
First, we would try to buy a local business. We didn't have enough capital, so we started renting a truck.
A lunch truck. They specialize in Philly cheesesteaks, hot sauce optional. Their wives make Mexican desserts to sell as well.
And then we rent a second truck. More work, but it's even better. Finally, we got our dream come true, like we're buying our truck. So we kind of like step by step, that's what we did.
That last step is a big one. Even used, the truck is more than $100,000. But if their bet pays off and one truck becomes half a dozen, in time they'll probably move up and out of the neighborhood too. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And as with any rule, there are exceptions to this one. Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, a businesswoman who stuck it out in South L.A. Now, let's do the numbers. The rally rallied on for a third day. The Dow jumped 0.8%, 113 points to close at 13,204. The NASDAQ added 0.2%, 20 points to end at 3050. And the S&P 500 advanced 0.2%, 9 points to finish at 1399. Pending home sales hit a near two-year high in March, and that sent housing stocks toward the roof. Ryland Group rose 14%, Pulte added 10%. Earnings season, of course, is in full swing. Starbucks beat profit and revenue expectations, but shares fell in after-hours trading. Blame rising coffee prices. Amazon went the other direction. Shares in the internet retailer flew up after the bell. Bonds rose, and the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.95%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used gadgets from your home or office, such as iPhones, iPads, iPods, Macs, or smartphones, so you can upgrade to the latest versions. At Gazelle.com, see what your used gadget is worth. Then mail it to Gazelle for free. Gazelle pays for the shipping, and you'll get paid fast. Gazelle helps you upgrade to the latest gadgets faster and gives you value for the used gadgets you replace. Find out what your used gadgets are worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, gazelle it.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the American Association for the Advancement of Science concludes its annual forum on science and technology policy. Also in the nation's capital, the Commerce Department releases its advance estimate gross domestic product report for the first quarter. and plant a tree, hug a tree, climb a tree. It's National Arbor Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Here's evidence that Apple and other smartphone and tablet makers are changing the game in yet another lucrative arena. Nintendo reported its first annual operating loss ever. The video game giant came up short by $533 million for its just-ended fiscal year. But it is still a long way from... Nintendo is still sitting on a mountain of cash, roughly $14 billion. But as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon tells us, analysts are warning of a need to change strategy.
So when's the last time you played Pokemon, Donkey Kong, or Super Mario? Industry watchers say chances are you've turned instead to something that's literally right at hand and a lot cheaper to play. CNET senior editor Dan Ackerman says alternatives like Angry Birds have stormed the casual gaming world and could end up leaving Nintendo behind.
People are playing a lot of games on their iPhones or their iPads, and even Facebook is a huge gaming platform. And the company has frankly always sort of played that down, said it's not really a big threat. Well, it turns out it really was a big threat.
Nintendo was forced to lower the price on its portable 3DS system to below cost. Its software franchises also lagged. It's banking on turning things around for Christmas with its next-generation Wii U, complete with a gyroscopic tablet-style controller. Analysts estimate that to break even, it'll have to be priced for as much as $350. Ackerman wonders if it can really attract new buyers.
People are used to, you know, paying $499 for an iPad that does so many things besides just play games. We may be in a whole different sort of pricing mindset now.
Wedbush Securities analyst Michael Pachter says rival systems from Microsoft and Sony appeal to more hardcore gamers and so don't face as serious a threat.
The guys who are playing Call of Duty aren't about to stop, you know, playing on their Xbox 360 or PS3 and go play Farmville on their PC or Angry Birds on their tablet.
Pachter suggests Nintendo could build a new fortune migrating its games to the iPad and other platforms, but he says that would likely require a shakeup at the top. The company's CEO has long resisted such licensing moves. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
You might think the more billionaires a country has, the better its economy. And for the most part, that is true. But commentator Ruchir Sharma says you need to look at how tycoons make their billions if you want to get an accurate gauge of an economy's health.
I doubt Forbes magazine ever intended its annual list of billionaires as anything but a celebration of wealth. But this list reveals a lot about the economic prospects of a country. Take Russia and India, for example. Between 2006 and 2011, only one new name cracked the top 10 billionaires in India and only two in Russia. That's a red flag. It's a sign those economies are generating too little competition with great wealth amassing in the hands of a few. If the average wealth of these tycoons climbs too high, the threat of political instability grows. Witness Russia's recent protest movement. Healthy economies should, of course, produce billionaires. But these tycoons should face competition and ideally emerge from cutting-edge industries, not sectors where political connections are key to success. Nearly 80% of Russia's billionaires got rich off commodities, a sector that is closely tied to political patronage. In fact, many of Russia's tycoons are holdovers from the post-Soviet fire sale of state assets. And India may be best known for its dynamic software and technology industries, but its billionaires list shows wealth shifting from the entrepreneurs. It's increasingly dominated by provincial kingpins who have cut deals with state governments to seize control of local industries like mining and real estate. Still, editors at Forbes might be glad to know the billionaire situation isn't all bad in emerging markets. In China, the super rich faced tremendous turnover. Only one name on the 2006 list survived to 2011. And not one has a fortune of more than $10 billion. This is because the Chinese government intervenes to prevent private empires. Capitalists might call that the heavy hand of socialism, but it's far preferable to governments like Russia's that conspire to concentrate unproductive fortunes among a privileged few.
Ruchir Sharma is the head of emerging market equities at Morgan Stanley and the author of Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles. Tell us your thoughts at marketplace.org. This Saturday at the cathedral that is Fenway Park, hundreds of items from Ted Williams' personal collection will be auctioned off. Want a memento from the Boston Red Sox slugger? Better get out your checkbook. Some bids are already at heights rivaling the Green Monster. Lynn Joliker of Station WBUR tells us why sports memorabilia auctions are still a hit.
They may just be things.
So this is the Babe Ruth ball in the collection. It's, as you can see, it's signed to my pal, Ted Williams from Babe Ruth.
But these things up for auction at Fenway Park were in the hands or flying off the bat of Ted Williams, one of the greatest hitters of all time. For Jim Gensheimer of San Francisco, who grew up in Massachusetts, that means memories.
The time I spent at Fenway with my father watching Ted Williams play, that's what jazzes me about it.
Those memories translate into money. That ball Babe Ruth signed for Williams, someone has already bid more than $53,000 for it online. And the plaque Williams got for winning the 1949 American League MVP, it's at $146,000.
Right or wrong, sports always transcends just about everything.
David Hunt is president of Hunt Auctions. He specialized in vintage sports memorabilia for 20 years. Hunt says the recent recession didn't really affect him much because a lot of his customers see the items he auctions as an investment as opposed to just collectibles.
Many, many times when we sell these sorts of collections, 5 years later, we'll get clients that'll contact us and say, we've been made aware that you sold Ted Williams' MVP award or Ted Williams' jersey. We'd like to buy that from the person you sold it to.
Longtime Red Sox fan Lois Dominique wishes she could bid on something that belonged to Ted Williams.
If I could, financially, not right now, but yeah.
The piece that's caught her eye, a picture of Williams kissing a bat.
This is, you know, the stuff my father talked about, you know. It's not the scandals and horrible things today. It's the good stuff. It's the true grit.
In Boston, I'm Lynn Joliker for Marketplace.
There's nothing like high unemployment, a shaky housing market, and a lukewarm recovery to get people thinking about not just the economy writ large, but their wallets and bank accounts, not to mention their futures.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said!
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. He's with us every week for Attitude Check, our partnership with Gallup exploring what Americans think about the big issues making the news. Frank, it's good to talk to you.
Good to be with you.
So as things are heating up in the race for president and the discussion around the economy is picking up, everything from, student loan debt, the big conversation this week, anything to do with jobs, how confident are Americans feeling about our economy?
Well, the key question of the moment is how comfortable people feel about their own personal finances. Mm. Actually, consumer confidence is up a little, but we have an interesting question where we say, just thinking about you personally, do you have enough money to live comfortably? And that has actually fallen. That's now at 60%. 6 out of 10 Americans say affirmative on that. And just a few years ago, in the middle of the last decade, that was well above 70%. The concern is, will that curtail spending and hurt the economy?
Well, out of curiosity, do you have any data about what people say is holding them back? Is there any one financial problem that's weighing on folks?
You know, it's all of the above. We ask what we call an open-ended question. Very interesting. We said, all right, tell us in your own words, what's the big financial problem facing your family today? And, it's not like healthcare costs dominate or energy costs, cost of gasoline. It's kind of all of the above. Actually, the number one response is I don't have enough money. Hmm. How's that for a pretty simple response? Then they mention healthcare costs, cost of owning or renting a home, the high cost of living, inflation, then gas prices, I'm in too much debt, and then unemployment, and then college expenses. But it's kind of like everybody has a different problem, but they all add up to continued financial angst.
Well, boy, I tell you, we certainly see that here at Marketplace in the questions that we get from listeners. And you know, the folks who are talking about, you know, not having enough money just month in and month out, then they start worrying about retirement down the road because they're not able to save anything. Has that come up in your survey?
Of those who are not retired, only 38% now say that they think they will have enough money to live comfortably when they retire. And that used to be well above 50%. So that's really causing angst out there. And guess what the age group is where that's highest? 50 to 64. And I'm assuming that's because they've seen their 401ks decimated in recent years, and they've been told that Social Security may go bankrupt. All of these things are adding on Americans' mindset when they think about retirement, and there's a lot of concern out there.
Any sentiment coming from younger Americans? How are they feeling about retirement?
Hope springs eternal in the breast of young people today. Over half of people 18 to 29 today say, sure, I'll have enough to live comfortably when I retire. After all, that's decades and decades away. But as you get closer to 65, you're less and less likely to be optimistic about having enough money to retire.
Well, I'm glad to hear that about those younger folks, because I suppose even though so many of them don't have jobs, they're still keeping the faith, right?
Yes, and I think that, as I mentioned, is simply because that's so far away. They're assuming that brilliant politicians and others will have the whole situation fixed by, when would it be, 2050 or 2060 or whenever it is they retire.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Frank Newport is editor-in-chief of Gallup. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, word from Hollywood, Florida, that the College Football Bowl Championship Series, or BCS, may be on its way out. The P word, as in playoff, is now being uttered by commissioners of the various conferences. Just what or who will decide which teams get into a playoff? Well, that is still under intense debate. But word is the BCS will no longer exist after the 2014 season. Boo-yah. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 113 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ was up 20 points, 0.2%. And the S&P 500 advanced 9 points, also 0.2%. Our editors include John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson. And the managing editor is George Judson. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.